Debrief of Epilogue, April 2025. There are a series of sections in the work, separated by prolonged caesuras or silences. Section 1. A distant orchestral introduction of the Bing Crosby 1945 recording of Where the Blue of the Night Meets the Gold of the Day. His voice comes forward to be quite frontal and then retreats into the distance again. This material provides necessary information regarding the song, namely, it's an extant object sung by a well-known crooner. It also reveals the original lyrics, allowing the comparison with the changed version sung later by the protagonist.
Like a halo, tenderly. If only I could see her.
Section 2 enters just before the previous phrase disappears. We eavesdrop on the protagonist preparing to make a recording of some kind. He proceeds to muck about, getting ready, forgotten glasses, nuisance leads, etc. But before he can begin, the recording ceases as he sighs in a resigned tone. Okay, this is the draft for just the first paragraph or so. And we'll see what happens. I think I need my glasses. Okay. This is dangerous. Like doing this in a secure spot. God, I wish it didn't have bloody leads all over the place. Would be good, wouldn't it? Note the candid, informal ambience of this recording, as well as its prosaic content, bringing the listener into the task as some sort of collaborator or conspirator. They are allowed to be alongside the protagonist as he speaks to them of simple banalities. Section 3. The introduction of the song is heard, this time featuring the voice of the protagonist with piano accompaniment, slightly filtered and placed in the intimate zone. The introduction is crucial as it refers to longing for real peace of mind by travelling back to the long ago. It describes the protagonist's present state as living in a dream of the days I used to know. It indicates that by going back to the long ago, he might find peace of mind. This is what I attempt to do in the work, by way of the fiction of Ted coming back to life and of us both meeting as contemporaries. Apart from the gender of the subject of the song being changed from female to male, only two lines have been altered. The original, "And the gold of her hair crowns the blue of her eyes, like a halo tenderly," has been replaced with "And the curls of his hair frame the blue of his eyes with a shadow's deepening hue." This depicts the face being in shadow, making it difficult to read. The shadow also carries the implications of the shades, the ancestors, generations of withheld access. The face containing the eyes, which give access to the soul, being in concealment. This is followed by an almost complete rendition of the song, full spectrum and also very close and frontal. The song gets to the final stanza, hovering over an expected 6-4-5-3-1 cadence, where the blue of the night meets the gold of the day, but the resolution never eventuates. The required perfect cadence is removed. Instead, there's a closely mic'd clicking sound of unidentified provenance, revealed later as the sound of colliding snooker balls.
Must I live in dreams of the days I used to know? Why can't I find real peace of mind and go back to the long ago? Where the blue of the night meets the gold of the day. Someone waits for me, and the curls of his hair frame the blue of his eyes with the shadows deepening hue. If only I could see him, oh, how happy I would be. Where the blue of the night meets the gold of the day.
So the tonal resolution of the song is hijacked by a noise, completely other in relation to what came before. It's a grammatical insult of gross proportions, foot-tripping the previous predictable tonal sequence. The expected final resolution, which equates with the fulfilment of the longed-for meeting, "If only I could see him, oh how happy I would be," is replaced with a substitution, a snooker, where access to the intended target is sidestepped. So the game functions as a model of the relationship in which direct access is never granted, the source of intimacy always being shrouded, impossible to grasp. The irony of this scenario should not be underestimated. The secure, predictable harmonic sequences of the song, supporting the melody and articulating the lyrics, elicit intense nostalgia within a familiar tonal context, until the final resolution is shattered by a gauche completely unrelated, unavoidable sound event. The tonal momentum carries the listener into a sonic trap. So as the listener closes their eyes and opens their mouth expecting chocolate, they are instead given a bitter surprise. This involves a deliberate juxtaposing of appropriated materials so that they form a metaphorical dramaturgy. The more the listener understands of the sources, the song and the game, the deeper the available expressive repercussions. This is, of course, no different from the experience of any artwork. The deeper the responses of a listener to tonal architecture, for example, the more profound will be their subjective response to music that exploits the tonal hierarchy. The more you know about reverse perspective, the more you will get from looking at a Russian icon. Section 4. The protagonist witnessed preparing to record in the first section now returns and proceeds to try again. He then reads from some sort of diary. The second section ends with a second snooker balls event. I'm going to try again. Monday, the 8th of November, 2021. No sleep last night. Plagued by the idea of a contemporary dialogue with Ted. Some facts. He was born on March the 21st, 1917, and died on March the 7th, 1991, 2 weeks before his 74th birthday. And coincidentally, on my mother's 68th birthday. I was 47 when he died. I'm now 78, and so I've outlived him. I have this memory of us sometimes meeting at the RSA in Egmont Street in New Plymouth, after he'd finished work and while I was home from university. He'd buy me a beer and we'd play a few rounds of snooker while munching on the cheese and crackers provided by the management. He'd introduce me to his friends as they came and went, and after a few times they'd greet me directly, inquiring how my studies were going and making veiled but affectionate innuendos about Ted. I loved the informality of these occasions and the window they provided into the ambience of his personal friendships. I was in my late teens, early 20s, and he was in his late 40s, early 50s. Of course, the father-son divide made any dialogue between equals impossible. Our roles were fixed, even although we were both adults. But what if I could somehow go back to the long ago and meet up with him again? Not at the now defunct RSA, unfortunately. There would only be a few years between us. We'd be contemporaries, no longer separated by his life experience outstripping mine. Both of us would know the feeling of turning 73, of witnessing our children growing into adults, of holding our firstborn grandchild, and of sensing the ultimate destination of our life's journey appearing at breakneck speed over the horizon. How might this shared life experience affect our attitudes towards each other? Might it lead to a closer familiarity, some sort of mutual solidarity, enabling an ease that could never be present in our mortal relationship? Would those vexed questions, so embedded in my psyche, so implacable in their continual need for answers, ultimately be diffused or even banished as no longer relevant? Would my constant search for real peace of mind regarding our relationship be no longer necessary? Section 5. The reduced harmonies of the song are now heard, close and frontal at first, but gradually receding over the horizon, while the protagonist renders the lyrics yet again in a very intimate ambience. As the piano chords retreat, the voice is left more and more exposed, emphasizing the changed lyrics as well as their fragile tone. This rendition is complete except for the final chord, leaving the phrase hanging on an imperfect fulcrum. This section is important in highlighting the fact that the piano chords are the reduced harmonies of the song, not merely inconsequential sonorities, so that when they are transformed later in the work, their role is more focused. Where the blue of the night meets the gold of the day, someone waits for me. And the curls of his hair frame the blue of his eyes with the shadows deepening hue. If only I could see him, oh, how happy I would be. Where the blue of the night meets the gold of the day, someone waits for. This time, the silence after the section is short-lived, leading to section 6. The protagonist proceeds to describe the fictional meeting between himself and Ted. On the last sentence, "I will be healed," slightly abstracted pictures form an unsettled cadence, followed by another short saggero. We agree to meet at the White Hart Hotel, an appropriate replacement for the RSA. I get there first and nervously wait. He arrives, we embrace, and realize we look like brothers, not father and son, and he notices how much I resemble his father, much more than him. The spectre of Mum hovers over us, and we both sense she can no longer be affected by any of the hurtful implications of our impending conversation. He can now be honest and forthright around the topic of his relationship with her, how this affected him, and consequently his behaviour towards me. But sitting opposite him, with a cold beer in my hand, the myriad of longed-for answers suddenly become hollow and unnecessary. They're replaced by one simple requirement. I find myself trying to remember the sound of his singing voice. I know the three of us used to sing a lot when I was little, in the batch at Chelmsford Street, but unlike with Mum, I can't bring the sound of his singing to mind. The only voice I hear is that of Bing Crosby. It's almost as though I've substituted that voice for his, making it my subjective touchstone, carrying the unconditional love that I craved. And I know if I can now experience the sound of his singing, I will be healed. Section 7. The chordal progressions of the song return, but as they retreat into the distance, they also elongate, losing their identifying ictus and bleeding into a sort of neutral spectral realm. The distancing seems to be making the original sonorities less and less real. They are, in fact, going back to the long ago. As they retreat, additional abstract sonorities appear, along with the sound of protracted rolling snooker balls spatialized to stalk the listener. The texture still exhibits the regular downward stepping of the song's harmonies, but with more and more prolongation and layering. The harmonic content also becomes more and more congested, blurring the tonal security of the original progressions. The entire texture becomes progressively clouded as the signals of the snooker game begin to intrude, becoming extremely ominous. Simultaneously, a further series of comments from the protagonist are heard, close and frontal. The initial phrase is the protagonist asking something of himself. Now's my chance. I know how he feels, but what do I say exactly? This is the crucial point in the work, where when offered the possibility of resolving a lifelong dilemma, the protagonist can't find appropriate words. He's stymied by his own empathy. I know how he feels. So he proceeds to go through the motions of the game via a monologue that's appallingly mundane and prosaic. The deep impact of the scenario is reduced to paltry, insignificant patter, even if all of them can be taken not only literally, but also as innuendos directed at the topic, which it seems is unsolvable. One more frame. A picture frame? Being framed or blamed for something you have not done? You set him up. A setup, being a scenario where someone is to be duped or tricked. Your break. Break. To fail. To shatter. That's an impossible shot. Maybe the shot is from a firearm, not a snooker cue, taking a cheap shot at someone. How many points for in-off? In-off is a mistake in snooker. The incorrect ball has been potted. Snookered. You're snookered when the ball you have to hit has been deliberately concealed by your opponent by enabling another ball to obscure it. Another beer? Another beer is what you have when you can make no further progress. Okay, home James. This is an admission of defeat. The game has not enabled any progress in the relationship. As these comments accrue, the snooker game becomes increasingly agitated until after the final comment, home James, the entire song returns, except for the final cadence, but assaulted by a cacophony of snooker madness until ultimately everything climaxes into darkness. now's my chance. I know how he feels. But what do I say exactly? One more frame. You set him up. Your break. That's an impossible shot. How many points for an off? Snookered. Another beer? Okay, home, James.
Why must I live in dreams of the days I used to know? Why can't I find real peace of mind and go back to the long ago? Where the blue of the night
light meets the gold all. Someone wait for me, and the curls of his hair frame the blue of his eyes with the shadows deepening hue. If only I could see him, oh how happy I would be. Where the blue meets the gold of the
day. The implications here are overt. In the light of the failure of the protagonist to find a way of communicating with his dead father, the song makes one final failed, desperate attempt. The two worlds, the nostalgic days I used to know, and the brutal reality of a devious snooker, are brought into stark relief. Section 8. The final section is relatively short, and apart from an initial distant quote of Bing Crosby's whistling of the song's middle eight, features abstracted events varying between pitched tones and spectrally tuned aggregates. In the last portion, there occur a few sonorities which might exhibit vocal provenance, but never overtly. This material seems to be attempting to cadence, but always sliding into tangential tonal impasses. The final sonority combines a sagging pitch cloaked by an unpitched texture. Thank you. Additional comments. The song. The song functions in various ways. 1. To change the gender of the subject from female to male by altering the lyrics, thus enabling the connection of the song to Ted. I see this as a snooker, employing guile towards achieving a particular objective. 2. To provide a vehicle for the protagonist to express certain attitudes and feelings, for example, going back to the long ago, and a dawn, where the blue of the night meets the gold of the day, that's not merely a meteorological phenomenon, but also a new beginning, where he and Ted might try again, just like the protagonist tries for a second time to make the recording. 3. To provide sonic materials of a certain nature, namely, pictures informed by a tonal hierarchy, a musical architecture that makes sense to the listener, one that is familiar and meaningfully expressive. This provides harmonic materials, chords, which are then separated from the melody and subsequently transformed to gain entry to a spectral universe at odds with the tonal pitches of the song. The ongoing contrast between these two categories is central to the idea of the work, namely, a paradox that can never be resolved. 4. The song is repeated in various guises. Usually it ceases before the end of the final phrase, leaving the tonal structure unresolved. The occurrences of completion are both in section 7, where the pitches are already extensively stretched and the texture is well on the way towards abstraction, thus camouflaging any sense of closure. 5. The harmonic reduction of the song continues well into section 7, the snooker game, and continually combines pitched elements with their spectrally inflated counterparts. The paradox is always presented in this manner, especially when seemingly even-tempered pitches from the song begin to sag and bend, always downwards. 6. This process culminates in section 8. The sounds are all either harmonisations of identifiable pitches from the song, using elements that disagree with the expected tonalities previously established in the work, or transformations of the reduced harmonies of the song, forming an abstract texture that only faintly carries hints of the original chords. Even although the final moment has the sensation of a perfect cadence, the final pitched tone demonstrates a slight instability, sagging as it ends, leaving a faint aurora of unpitched material to conclude the work. Note, the abstract nature of this section is heard within the context of everything that has come before, so that it's co-opted by the overall message of the work. It contains the abstracted residue of the song. And now a few other notes. Note 1. The tendency of the pitched materials to fail, lose their temperament, and gradually descend into a noisified texture causes an inevitable reduction of strategic eloquence. The noise sounds can only relate in first-order adjacent connection, unlike the pitches, which have the potential to provide deeper, more profound eloquence. Note 2. The effectiveness of spectromorphological transformation of any sort depends upon the potency of the source file. An abstract sonority, separated from any subjective connection to some sort of narrative or strategic objective, and incapable of independent hierarchical relationships, will fail to speak, no matter how aesthetically effective the transform, because the original parameters of that file need to carry a meaningful implication, some sort of expressive reciprocal. I call this quality subjective potentization. Note 3. The most important point to make is the overt role of the commentary. It's a narrative, a story, a yarn. It establishes a conceptual environment, an idea, within which every sound, referential or abstract, might play its part. To this extent, the spoken narrative is not apprehended primarily as sonority, but as data, forming an armature to which the expressive sound world might adhere. Note 4. The role of the caesura. The duration of the pause is critical, and is calculated by establishing the build-up of expressive momentum in the preceding section. There will be a particular period of following silence that balances this momentum. The amount of extra duration then applied to the pause stretches the join between the two adjacent episodes. When must the silence be halted by the next event is a complex but critical decision. An analogy. A pass between adjacent players in rugby football when both are at full stretch. If the pass is low, it will risk grounding before it reaches the adjacent player. But if he or she has enough skill, they'll reach down with no reduction in pace and grasp the ball just before it hits the ground and then continue the attack. For the onlooker, that moment of will he, won't she is memorable. The entire success of the attack is brought down to a single instant, thus amplifying the moment beyond those surrounding it. It elicits an intake of breath, followed by, if successful, an exclamation of appreciation, and if not, an exclamation of disappointment. It's no longer just another pass. The vulnerable point in the attack has been dramatised by the embodied risk. So, the extra moment of time added to the caesura, which stretches but never breaks the silence, can be enormously potent.